The God part of the brain. You're going to love the next couple hours with Matthew Alper when he comes back with us in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Matthew Alper, with us on Coast to Coast. And, of course, he was educated at Vassar, North London University. He acquired a degree in philosophy of science. After finishing school, he spent extensive time living abroad in Europe, Africa, and Asia. He went on to become a screenwriter and then write his own work, The God Part of the Brain. He's back on Coast to Coast after a couple-year absence. Matthew, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me back.
How has life been?
All's been well. Thanks for asking.
Good. Perfect. Perfect. Now, since we last chatted a couple of years ago, This whole planet seems to be upside down. What's happening?
Honestly, I think the planet's been upside down from the beginning of humankind.
Yeah.
It's just that we have bigger weapons to hurl around at each other, so it seems a little more obvious. And also with the population growth, it seems a little more obvious. But we're a pretty flawed species. And we've been a bit of a mess since day one. We're the neurotic animal, and we're bound to get ourselves into trouble. And, even a couple of years back when we last spoke, there was wars and there was chaos. And I guess it depends, we're fortunate that we live in the United States where things are mostly stable. But, from the beginning of time, it depends where you are. There are pockets of the world that are, that are hell holes. So I think it's kind of the same old story, just a different year.
I think so too, Matthew. The title of your book, The God Part of the Brain, I think is very telling, but I want you to tell us how you came up with that title.
Well, because it pretty much summarizes the concept, the premise of my idea,
yeah,
which is that I suggest that the fact that every human culture, no matter how isolated, has believed in some form of a spiritual reality would suggest that humans are genetically predisposed to a belief system, that there are parts of our brain that generate what we call spiritual and religious experiences, which compel us to believe that there's some form of a transcendental reality. I write about this as an evolutionary adaptation, something that evolved in our brains in order to help our species survive our unique awareness of death. So it's a coping mechanism. It gives us the comfort of that even though we know that the body will perish, that we will die and lose everyone that we love, including ourselves, we have this comforting sensibility that there's this other side, this spirit that we all possess. And even though the body will die, the spirit will live on. And since all perception and thought comes from the brain, I'm suggesting that there are literally, just like there are language parts of the brain, emotional parts of the brain, basically every part of who we are and how we think comes from the brain, that these experiences also are derived from the brain.
In terms of spirituality, Matthew, does that have anything to do with the brain, or is that something else?
No, well, what I'm suggesting is, so there's a science called sociobiology, which basically suggests any behavior that's universal to any species has a genetic component. So for instance, the fact that all cats meow or beavers build dams or dogs bark, it's not a coincidence or an accident. It's because they're genetically predisposed to do so. And again, since all behavior comes from the brain, that would mean, for instance, in the case of cats, even if you took a kitten away from its mother at birth, it's still going to grow up to meow, meaning it's a built-in instinct. And again, since behavior comes from the brain, that would suggest that the brain isn't some nilly-willy organ, that it would mean that somewhere in all cats' brains, there's a very specific part, a series of neural connections that generates what we could call meowing behavior. If you damage that part, cats will lose their ability to meow. Same thing's true with humans. All human cultures communicate through language. So we could say humans are a linguistic animal. With the aid of neuroscience, we now know what those parts are. There's the Wernicke's area, Broca's area, angular gyrus. If you damage one of those parts, either a tumor hinges on them or you get banged in the head, you'll lose, if you suffer damage to one of those parts, you'll suffer what's called an aphasia, damage to that specific intelligence. So again, what I'm suggesting is the fact that every human culture has had these spiritual inclinations and described their spiritual experiences in such a similar way with the same descriptors would suggest that it's part of our nature, that it's an instinct, which would mean that there are parts of our brain, specific regions, that are responsible for, regardless if you take 10 different people from 10 different religions and have them meditate, pray in the midst of what would be called a mystical experience, the same thing is happening in their brain. So I'm basically suggesting, now I write about this from the perspective of an atheist.
Right.
I'm suggesting there is no spiritual reality, that basically I call this nature's white lie, a coping mechanism that was selected into the human brain, into human consciousness, to make us a more survivable organism in light of our unique awareness of death.
Did this evolve, or did we always have this hardwired belief system?
Well, it evolved in as much as humans evolved. So it's part of our species. Everything that comprises our species, Homo sapien, is something that we had from day one. So we're the same animal we were approximately 100,000 years ago when our species first emerged. When we first emerged, we were a linguistic animal, a musical animal. All of the higher comprehensions that we possess today were the same as we were when we first born into the world, when we first evolved. So it's not like humans at one point were not spiritual and then became spiritual. It's part of our nature. So, and basically in anthropological studies, when they study, the evolution of the hominids, the predecessors of Homo sapien, they found that there's really no indication of any other animal possessing spiritual consciousness except for Neanderthal man, which they found also did perform burial rituals and would bury their deceased, leaving them with certain relics suggesting that they believed that person was perhaps getting sent to some other side, to the next realm. So other than Neanderthal man, Homo sapien, our species, is the only other animal that seems to ever have evolved this instinct. Now, what I suggest, what I write, is that this was an offshoot of self-conscious awareness, which is unique to our species. No other animal basically has self-comprehension. And I write that this self-conscious awareness, which makes us this unique animal, is also what makes us the most powerful species on Earth, because it enabled us with the power of self-modification. So unlike every other species on Earth, let's say an ice age comes, whereas every other species has to sit back and passively wait however many millions of years to evolve a thicker coat of fur, humans can say, I am cold, because we have self-conscious awareness. On top of that, we have the digits to do something about it. So within an hour, we can sew ourselves a coat of fur. So it's almost like we've transcended the process of natural selection because of our brains, because of self-conscious awareness, which has enabled us to transform the planet. So for instance, if we look and we see a bird flying, we don't have to say, wow, that's a cool idea. It'd be nice if in 10 million years we evolve wings. We can say, those could be to our advantage. Let's build a pair. And next thing we know, we're flying, or we're in a submarine underwater, or we're walking on another planet on the moon. So again, self-conscious awareness is what made us the most powerful species on Earth. However, the drawback was it made us the first animal aware of our own mortalities. And the anxiety created by that awareness, that death is inevitable, that we can't fight it and we can't flee it. There's nowhere to run, there's nowhere to hide, there's no fortification tall enough to protect us from death, that basically the anxiety of that awareness was so overwhelming that I suggest it forced the selection of this evolutionary adaptation, this coping mechanism built into us, this comforting device that gives us this sense that there's this other part of us, this spirit. Mm-hmm. And the word spirit exists in every culture on the planet, whether you go into the jungles of the Amazon or, you know, indigenous peoples of the Pacific Islands. So again, I'm suggesting that because of self-conscious awareness, nature selected, or we evolved this coping mechanism that compels us to believe that there's this transcendental reality out there, so that when the physical body dies, our spirit will continue, and that comforts us.
It does comfort us. So I assume, though, you're also saying that when the physical body dies, there is no spirit.
Correct. Right. I mean, from, you know, again, writing from the perspective of one might call a scientist, you know, my sense of consciousness is that it emanates from our organ, the brain, a very physical organ, one that does not possess a ghost in the machine. So that basically, once we die, once the brain dies, actually, what we consider consciousness or a soul ceases to exist. So our sense of self, and we don't even have to die. I mean, we could get hit in the head and suffer a coma. We could get Alzheimer's disease, and our sense of self is compromised. So even before death, we could lose our, in quote, soul or conscious, you know, conscious sense of self. So again, to me, there is no soul, there is no ghost in the machine, there is no spirit. What comprises you and I, what I might refer to as Matthew and you refer to as George, is an entity that's created within the confines of our organ, the brain.
Now I have to ask you, though, that without the belief system, how did this incredible, incredible universe get put together where everything seems to be in order? And here we are. I mean, we're doing this international radio program right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, how did all this happen?
Mm-hmm. Well, see, again, one of the key words in your question is you said it seems that there's an order. That's the way the human brain operates. We look for patterns. We look for order. So we project that sensibility onto the universe at large when our comprehension of the universe, really, we have no sense of what really goes on with the world at large. For me, that's just nature at work. You know, it might seem fascinating, and it might seem, when we project our own sensibilities onto it, that there's something what we might call magical going on. Like, you know, how could it be? It seems so perfect. It's just the unfolding of nature. I mean, sure, you look at images from the Hubble telescope, or the way a star forms, or planets, or, you know, all of it, the way life evolved. And it seems that there's this construct, this order behind it. You know, so we're constantly, again, because we are programmed to look for that higher power, we project that sensibility onto the universe at large and make presumptions that there must be some being, some higher consciousness out there that gave this order, that created this order, which ultimately ended up giving birth to us as a species.
That's remarkable. You know, and I am sure many individuals have their doubts about God and about life after death, and they have, for a moment at least, stopped and thought and said, my God, this is it. This is it. But then something kicks in, and they pull away from that. They then believe in God. They believe in life after death. Are you saying that thing that kicks in is like a protective mechanism to keep us from really flipping out?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, that thing that kicks in is often our awareness of our mortalities. So, you know, a lot of people kind of cruise through life and they don't really give it much thought, but then the next thing they know, they lose a loved one, or they suffer an illness and they suddenly, for the first time, have to look at their own selves and their own mortalities, or they lose a parent or a child, or some, you know, tragic thing occurs, and they can't suffer it alone. We need the comfort of this sense that, no, there's got to be something else out there. I know that they're still with us somehow. I can't experience this loss. It's so tragic and horrific to think that this person I loved with all my heart, including our own selves, is going to perish and not exist forevermore. The notion of eternal nothingness is so horrifying, and rightfully so. I mean, you know, it horrifies me. I don't like the idea, but what they've found in studies is that basically fear is often the mechanism that triggers religious and spiritual consciousness, that suddenly people who didn't really think that much about it suddenly become very religious, find themselves going to church, find themselves praying to God, because they need that comfort.
I have got to assume that you believe that there is some other intelligent life out there on the universe, that we are not alone.
Well, that's completely speculative. I would say that given the vast space in the universe, that there's, I would say it's likely that there is other intelligent life. There's a sort of smallish ring in the universe of where life could exist, where it's not too hot, not too cold, etc. But even within that ring, we're talking about such a tremendous amount of space and so many stars and so many planets that, yes, I would say if I had to put money down, I would guess that there is other life. And probably, since the mechanisms of evolution probably work on, you know, every planet where life might evolve, that life has also evolved to a higher intelligence. Where you and I might differ, however, is that I don't believe we've ever had contact with that intelligent life, nor do I believe we ever will.
Well, you may be right about that. We're with Matthew Alper. His book is called The God Part of the Brain. His website, godpart.com, linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. Is it possible, Matthew, that you could be wrong and that there is a God?
It's absolutely possible. I'm an atheist, but, you know, even a scientist realizes that every theory, you know, really only holds water 99.9999999% of the time. So even though the sun has set in the west every day from the beginning of our experience with it, who knows, tomorrow something different might occur. However, you know, just having researched the amount of science I have, you know, again, if I had a bet, I would say chances are there is no God and there is no spiritual reality. But, you know, I'm not God myself, so I can't say anything with absolute certainty. So I would have to allow for the possibility that absolutely I could be wrong.
There's no question in my mind that modern religion has been set up to create fear, to scare human beings, to control, to manipulate.
Are we talking about Donald Trump or religion right now?
Are you showing your colors, your political colors? But
I have no colors. I just stand for sanity and for the hopes that civilization will last another couple hundred years.
This is going to be a strange election, my friend. It really is weird.
It's already been.
But organized religion, I think it was created to control people. What do you think?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, most institutions are. And, you know, basically, religion lays down a series of customs and laws and norms and regulations. So absolutely, it's a mechanism of control. And it's often, you know, used in side with fear. So absolutely, that is part of the mechanics of religion. Scare people into believing in whatever God you feed them, and then they'll do what you tell them.
We're going to come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM with Matthew Alper as we talk about his book, The God Part of the Brain. In the second hour, the last hour of the program, we will take your phone calls and your questions, of course. But I've got a lot more myself when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast, Matthew Alper with us. Matthew, if humans are genetically predisposed to believe in life after death or believe in God, what about those like you who do not? What happened? Who short-circuited you?
Excellent question. It's why I have a chapter in my book called Why Are There Atheists? So, essentially, for every cognitive trait we possess, we fall into a bell curve. Actually, every trait we possess. So let's take height. If we took a population of any given 1,000 people and measured them, they would fall into a height bell curve.
Mm-hmm.
So the majority of people would fall into what we call average height, but because of genetic variance on the tapering extremes, there would be those people who fall into the side of being excessively small, and on the other side of that same curve, there'd be the people who are excessively tall. Take something like musicality, also an inherited trait. Every culture has had music. Humans are a musical animal. Some people are born gifted, some people are born tone deaf. Again, if we take this bell curve of musicality, the average human being has what we would call average musical potential. Most humans are musical on some level, but on the tapering extremes of that bell curve, some people are born tone deaf. You could have them instructed by the greatest teachers on earth, and they'll barely be able to hum Mary Had a Little Lamb at the
right,
end.
Right, and keep it in tune.
Mm-hmm. Whereas on the other side, there are some people born with, you know, as savants. At 5 years old, they hear Beethoven for the first time, and they sit at a piano, and they repeat it. So again, it's part of our wiring, and because of genetic variance, though the average person has average potential, there are the tapering extremes of this bell curve. The same thing applies to both spirituality and religiosity. The average human is spiritual and religious. However, on those tapering extremes, you have some people who are born with a predisposition to be hyper-religious. They maybe are giving heartfelt, you know, sermons from the pulpit when they're 5, 6, 7 years old. And on the other extreme, you have people who are born what we might call spiritually tone deaf. They don't get it. They don't care. Their families could be talking about God, religion. And I've had people write to me and say, after reading your book, I felt so much better because I grew up in a family of, like, let's say, 8 kids. We went to church every weekend. Everyone in my family was very religious. They prayed. Some of them spoke in tongues. And they were like, I never cared. I never got it. I kind of pretended. I went along pretending that I cared because I didn't want to be an outcast, but it never had any meaning to me. And they're like, I read your book, and it suddenly made sense. So ergo, why some people... Now, it's not purely genetic, obviously, like right. Same with musicality. You know, one could be born with a disposition towards musical genius, but... You know, if you're too poor to have ever been provided with a musical instrument or musical instruction, you're never going to realize your genius. So obviously there's, you know, it's like with all behaviors, it's a combination of nature and nurture, things that, you know, need to be nurtured or not. So I'm not suggesting that everyone who is a strong believer, you know, it was because of their genetic makeup, and everyone who is non-religious, it was also because of their genetic makeup. Their nurturing plays a role as well. But for instance, to show the nature side of it, they've done identical twin studies where they did a University of Virginia did the most ambitious identical twin study ever with 40,000 sets of identical twins. And they mostly found identical twins who had been separated at birth. And then they studied their behaviors. And what they found was, in regard to religiosity, as compared to fraternal twins separated at birth, identical twins separated at birth had a 50% higher likelihood that if one twin happened to be extremely religious, it was 50% higher odds that the other identical twin, though they had never met and they were raised in different places by different families, were just as likely to also be extremely religious. Or on the opposite side, not religious at all, thus showing that there is a genetic factor involved.
I get asked a lot about my belief system about life after death. And, you know, my answer to most is, I don't know. That I think there is, but I don't know. And the answer that I give people, Matthew, is pretty cut and dry. And that is, if there is life after death, I'm going to know about that when I pass. If there isn't, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not going to know about it anyways. It's over. Here's the question. What do you say to people who claim that they've seen ghosts and spirits and all these other apparitions?
I think the key word there is claim. I mean, look, there's people claiming all sorts of things. There's people claiming they've seen Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster. There's people claiming they were abducted by UFOs. Basically, I believe, look, you could take, if we interviewed people from all over the world, depending on what religion they believe in, you know, if we go to the Middle East, there are going to be people who claim they experienced Allah. They saw a vision of Muhammad. You go to Christian nations, and you'll have similar people who, with the same conviction, but their visions were of Jesus or of Mother Mary. We project our belief systems onto the reality beyond us at large. But again, to me, they're just claims, because it really wouldn't, if we went back to ancient Greece, there'd be people making claims that they saw Zeus or Hera or one of the Greek gods. The likelihood that all of these different people making all of these different claims in regard to their specific set of beliefs, obviously those same beliefs contradict one another. So either only one of them is right and all the rest are wrong, or more likely they're all wrong. I believe most people who are actually making claims, putting out their things that, like, you know, they've done studies and they found ghosts in a haunted house, etc. To me, most of those people are probably charlatans who are just looking for attention, to sell books, to make money, because chances are I don't necessarily believe that they believe it.
Is it conceivable that early human beings did not have this wiring at all and that it developed later on?
Again, things that are instinctual, that involve the mechanics of the brain, have to do with the species at large. So once we evolved, we had these parts. And it's also, that notion is also supported by anthropological evidence, where dating back to like the first evidence of recorded history, humans were burying their dead, were performing burial rituals. There's evidence of shrines built in order to pray and serve one's god, sacrifices made. You know, there are sacrificial, sites where cultures from pre-recorded history were, you know, killing animals or in some cases humans.
Humans, sure.
The Aztecs, they didn't have a written language, but we know through recorded history, through, you know, that basically they were performing human sacrifices. And this goes back even to Paleolithic man. There's instances of in art, that there was religious art, this sense of even in cave drawings, that there was a belief in some type of spirit, that they would, you know, that they would have these rituals where they would draw beasts on the wall and then draw like spears going through them, hoping to leave omens that were good, you know, hopeful for an upcoming hunt. So all evidence suggests that from the dawn of our species, humans have been a spiritual and religious animal with beliefs in some form of a spiritual realm.
Matthew, when you put together the God part of the brain, was it easy for you or was it a difficult write?
It was Herculean. It was the most difficult thing that I've ever done or ever will do. No matter what else I do on this earth in this lifetime, I will never match the achievement. This is my magnum opus. There's a vast wealth of research in here. I often get letters from people saying, thank you for writing this. I learned more science and philosophy than I did in my 4+ years of college and even postgraduate studies. I took about 2.5 years off of life, living on savings, just spending time in libraries and researching and writing. And, it was a real puzzle to have to put it together. All of the questions, for instance, that you're asking me now, I had to think through what kind of questions are people going to ask?
Mm-hmm.
What might be some, you know, negative criticisms? And I had to foresee all of those and then in many cases come up with a chapter that would be an answer to those questions, such as why are there atheists?
And there are. I'm talking to one. We've had a few call the program and we've had other races. Most scientists are atheists. How come?
Well, because when you've, been trained to look at the world and the universe and yourself from such a logical and rational perspective, you tend to put aside the more emotional part of our experience, which tends to lead us to believe in these types of things, these spiritual realities, be it gods, be it spirits, be it whatever the case may be. Scientists are more rational-minded. They're skeptics. They need proof before they're ready to adhere to any belief. So, and if you're looking for proof, I mean, man's been looking for proof of their gods from the beginning of time. And with all the video cameras out there today, we've yet to see, a video of Jesus walking on water, or, tales from the Bible of God sweeping, or the angel of death sweeping across a nation and killing, the firstborn. For some reason, it ain't happening today. So it's a nice myth to believe in from the past. But now that we've got all the scientific evidence in front of us, for those who are more skeptical, like myself, we're saying, show me the proof.
Mm-hmm. Have you always been this way, even since you were a child? Or did you change?
I was a questioning child. I was a curious child, and I wanted to get, basically ever since I had my first experience where I became aware of the notion of death, that I am going to perish, that there is eternal nothingness waiting for me ahead, that terrifying notion of loss of everything, and including then the fear of and what about my parents? Are they going to die too? And once I first conceived of that notion, it was so terrifying to me. And of course, people were trying to comfort me. Well, our spirits go to heaven, and we'll all be joined together, so you'd have nothing to fear.
Well, you didn't believe that, did you?
I questioned it. I was like, I don't know. Sounds a little fishy. And plus, how do they know? Because nobody seemed to really know for sure. And I kind of had the feeling that it was a story I was being told to make me feel better. So, as a matter of fact, I ended up writing a book because people, when I'm interviewed about this, they always say, well, why did you write this book? So I actually thought I had an interesting enough backstory that I wrote a prequel to The God Part of the Brain called Icarus of Brooklyn, A Spiritual Quest Gone Wrong, which, if you go to Amazon, one can purchase that as well, and soon to be a motion picture.
Good for you. Who's going to star in it, do you know?
Well, I think I can still pass for 18, so I'm probably going to be the
You're going to be it. You're going to be Hitchcock in your own book. So did anything happen to you as a youngster that got you to push yourself away from believing in a god or in an afterlife?
I was, as I think once I became sort of maybe a teenager, I found myself a little bit skeptical.
A parent, for example, may lose a child and definitely walks away from God.
Embraces or walks away, one way or the other.
Exactly.
No, there was no one thing. As I, as I became a teenager, I found myself very curious. I would say I was an agnostic. I was open-minded. I really didn't feel sure one way or the other, but I was hoping to get to the bottom of things. So I found myself getting very interested in science because it seemed like the closest thing to a paradigm that offered, valid explanations of things, of phenomena. And I studied a lot of science, and I began studying a lot of philosophy, and I started studying comparative religion. I started studying meditation. I started exploring using different drugs as a possible means to perhaps break on through to the other side. I pretty much felt like I'm going to leave no stone unturned until I get to the bottom of this. And there was no one really deciding factor, and it wasn't until I was sometime in my late 20s that I began thinking about these things again, and I had my eureka moment where all of a sudden I came up with the concept of the God part of the brain, and that's when I started writing the book.
Have you tried to conceive the thought on how this all started, how the universe started from nothing? That's a difficult question.
Right. And again, based on the way we as a species are wired to seek out answers, it's part of our nature to look for a framework, for look for patterns, to look for order. We look for beginnings of things. We look for origins. Where did it come from? It's how we survive. So we project these sensibilities onto the universe at large, like there must be a beginning, there must be an end. I have a feeling that when it comes to ultimate time, as opposed to human time, concepts like beginning and end don't even apply. That we live in a space and a dimension that's so vast and incomprehensible to us that, you know, if there were more intelligent life than ourselves and they heard us asking questions about how and why and when did it begin, they'd be laughing, thinking like, oh, they're still stuck in that temporal mode of perception. So I don't know. I mean, obviously there's no way one could explain how did anything get here? Why is there a universe, period? But it's not my nature. I'm not inclined to believe that it means that it's proof in itself that there's an intelligent designer. I just believe that nature, or whatever one wants to call it, is a phenomena that happens to be, for whatever reason, probably no reason at all, that just things are, the universe is, and we'll never know why.
Do you get into heated discussions? I mean, do people get mad at you when they realize where you're coming from?
Well, between the shows that I've done with either you and or Art Bell, for instance, I've
You
certainly received my share of hate mail.
do? Well,
Oh, yeah.
that's sadly expected.
Yeah, you know.
And you'll get that tonight.
Perhaps.
It'll be interesting when we open up the phone lines, Matthew, to see what we get.
It always is.
It's very difficult for people outside of religion to come up with a concept of how we are, who started us, how did we get here. And so I think, as you say, the brain has been wired to create a God to answer these questions. It's very easy for people to say, well, God did it.
Absolutely. It's as quick an answer. It's like the crib notes to the universe. How do we get here? One word, God. And it gives us a sense of security. It's an
No,
anchor.
it does. Matthew, we're going to take a break. We're coming back for the final hour. We'll talk more and take phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.